Welcome to episode 6 of Popcorn and Prosecco, a full 30 minutes of nonstop movie talk. This week we're going to hit Muppets Most Wanted, the new amazing Spider-Man 2 trailer and footage, Rooney Mara's casting in Pan and Divergent. I'm Perry Nemiroff, and here are my co-hosts, Angie Han and Christy Pachko.
Hello.
Hey, everybody.
All right, so let's jump into it. Angie, you want to introduce Muppets?
Yes. So this week, one of the big releases coming out is Muppets Most Wanted, which is, you know, a sequel to 2011's The Muppets. And this one is a fun European caper. So it picks up right after the last movie ended, with Kermit and the other Muppets deciding that they're going to go on a European tour. But once they're there, it turns out that the manager that convinced them to go there, who is played by Ricky Gervais, has this diabolical plot to help his boss, who is a criminal mastermind that looks exactly like Kermit, switch places with Kermit. So Kermit gets sent to a Siberian gulag that is run by Tina Fey in a really thick Russian accent, while Constantine, his doppelganger, is pretending to be Kermit and hanging out with the Muppets and going on tour with them. So that's basically the plot of the movie. Ty Burrell also has a subplot as a super French Interpol agent who has to team up with Sam the Eagle to try and track down the bad guys. And that was my favorite part of the movie. I would watch an entire franchise. That was just Ty Burrell's character and Sam the Eagle going on fun little adventures. I love that. Otherwise, I thought the movie, it's fun. I don't think that it's must-see viewing like the last one was, and a lot of that is that it doesn't really have that much emotional depth. The last one had like some really like, you know, poignant strains to it. It was bittersweet, you know. This one is just wants to be fun. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it does make the movie feel a little bit more slight. Christy, what did you think?
Yeah, I'd actually second that. I liked it, but I feel like you can't not compare The Muppets with The Muppets Most Wanted, which I keep wanting to call Muppets Again, because one, it was called that early on, and two, there's a song number that's essentially where they're like, Muppets Again, and it's just like, why is it called Muppets Most Wanted?
It's exceedingly obvious that that was the title until, like, right before they decided to release it.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's fun. It is fun. I enjoyed myself. I was going to miss the press screening in New York because I was in Ireland, so I made it a point. It was already open in Ireland, so I went with my husband and saw it in theaters in Ireland, which movie tickets are crazier expensive there, and they charge extra on holidays, so fun
time. How much was your this is
totally side note. It was because it was a holiday. My ticket was
charge extra on holidays.
Yeah, it was like 11.30 pound or euros. So the translation, it's like about as much as it is in New York. But I was surprised because it was like a matinee showing, so it should have been cheaper. But then they charged me more for the matinee showing because anyway. So yeah, sorry Ireland, you guys pay too much for movies because like that's how much we pay in New York, and it's a dumb amount of for movies. Anyhow. Otherwise, that Ireland was beautiful, and I could go on and on, but I won't because that's obnoxious. So Ireland was great. But the movie, I had a lot of fun. I liked the romping adventure of it, but it's not as strong as the first movie. There's not the emotional depth, and I think a large part of that is because the story is so fractured, where in the first movie it was all about getting the Muppets together, but then we also focused on these brothers and this. So there was like a core narrative that kept us going, and in this one we keep being thrown around, where there's the subplot with Kermit in the gulag, and there's a subplot about Sam Eagle and Ty Burrell solving crimes, and there's a subplot about Constantine and Ricky Gervais trying to steal things, and it's so much going on that it's really hard to focus and get involved. And then on top of that, only one of those threads involves a Muppet anybody actually cares about.
Like, yeah, that was one of the things that I liked it, but then afterwards I was like, wait, there weren't actually that many Muppets in it. Kermit has an important plot. Miss Piggy, has important things to do. But, you know, the rest of the Muppets are basically, they have cameos. They're about as important to the narrative as, like, the human cameos are.
Yeah, I was disappointed. It's really strange because it's like they spend a fair amount of time with Walter, who they brought in the first movie, and I don't get what that's about because it's like Walter's fine, but like he's not a major character. Miss Piggy gets weirdly sidelined. Gonzo's like an under 5. Fonzie is sidelined. It's like these are the characters we love the most. Why are they getting so pushed to the back?
Yeah, meanwhile, the human characters have, like,
I say that,
you know,
as I literally have Gonzo behind me. I see Perry giggling.
No.
That wasn't even, guys, that's just good podcasting.
I'm losing my mind because thanks to a Google Hangout quirk, there's, like, a second you, and it's literally, like, frozen on you taking a swig of what looks like a big wine glass. Wine bottle. Oh.
That's actually me posing with a Ron Swanson mug. Because I'm classy.
No. It's a frozen image of you drinking your cider.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay.
I'm going to screen grab it. Oh, it just slipped away. I was going to screen grab it so we could show everyone.
We can edit out this little digression, right?
If you want to.
Whatever. We'll just move. I'm going to press ahead.
I think
ahead
the video it doesn't.
But yeah, so. Anyway. I liked it, but it takes all these derailments, and it's like, I go to see a Muppet movie to watch about the Muppets I like and care about, and I've spent decades paying attention to a particular group of Muppets, and now they want me to give a shit about Constantine, which, like, well, not really that they want you to care about him, but it's like, we spend so much time with that character, and with Ricky Gervais's character, and it's not like he's one of those cads that you get to love, he's just a cad in this movie, it's not interesting, and, like, they get a whole song number that I'm like, why is this here? And the song number... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Say about the song numbers.
I was going to say, the song numbers aren't nearly as strong as the first movies either. Like, they're fun, but, like, I didn't walk out, like, singing any of them to myself, where when I left The Muppets, I wanted to sing Man and Muppet all the time. Like, that Man or Am I a Muppet's really fun. There's nothing on that level in this one. Like, there's nothing in here I think will get nominated for an Oscar, basically. Which I know sounds crazy, but let's remember, it won the Oscar. There's nothing in here that feels...
I think that the opening number, the We're Doing a Sequel, is really fun, and it starts out really strong. It's just, you know, it's really knowing and, like, funny and goofy in the way that, you know, you want the Muppets to be. But then the rest of the numbers weren't that – they were okay, and part of the problem is that they give most of the musical numbers to characters that we just met. Mm-hmm. You know, like, the Muppets themselves – you see a few snippets of them performing, but most of them don't get any musical numbers. The musical numbers go to people like Tina Fey and Ricky Gervais. But I wanted to go back to something you were saying about Constantine, about how he's not someone you grow to love. I wouldn't say that I loved him, but I kind of felt like one of the problems with this movie was that I was like, has Kermit always been that much of a drag?
Yeah, that they don't even notice?
No, but it's just, he... You know, he's always kind of like the more practical one out of the Muppets, but here he was such a wet blanket, and he was like really whiny about, you know, people not listening to him. And he was really mean to Miss Piggy, by the way. She wants to get married, which, you know, they've been together for decades at this point, I guess. I don't know what it is in the timeline of the show, but he's, you know, he's just like snapping at her and being just like, you know, I don't...
Really dismissive of her needs. And I mean, admittedly, she's pushy. She's like, we're getting married. She basically tells him. Which is also confusing in the Muppets chronology, and they don't address that, because they did get married in Muppets Take Manhattan, which is another thing. There's like a lot of references to the other movies, and not in a way of like... chronology or canon, but just like, remember, like, they, you know, there's like a cutaway to Rainbow Connection, and there's like allusions to The Great Muppet Caper, which did the heist thing in Europe, and in my opinion did it better. So it feels like a rehash of a lot of their old stuff instead of a fresh new take on them, which is such a disappointment.
I mean even the
premise of, like, let's take these familiar characters and set them loose on Europe. Like, one, they already did that in the 80s, and two, like, there's nothing about it that feels exceptionally fresh. Like, they go to all these locations, but they don't really do anything that interesting in these settings.
Yeah, I'm starting to think that between The Muppets and Muppets Most Wanted, which involved most of the same behind-the-scenes talent, I'm starting to think that
James Bobbins, I guess?
And Nicholas Stoller kind of know how to write movies around the Muppets, but not really about the Muppets. Because the last one, if you think about it, wasn't really about the Muppets we know either. It was about Jason Segel and Amy Adams and this new Muppet, Walter. Mm-hmm. And this one, you know, it's the same thing.
Which
I feel like if you make another movie, it's going
to
once again be about, you know, a bunch of new characters that they bring in who hang out with the Muppets.
Yeah, the first one made sense to me in that they were also trying to introduce the Muppets to generations that didn't know them. So I got that, and it played
it was about the experience of loving the Muppets and you know, of like seeing the franchise revitalized. So that made sense at least. But in this one, I was like, there's no real need that we need to get to know Tina Fey's prison guard character as well as she does, especially because it turns out that her only real motivating factor is that she's madly in love with Kermit.
Which doesn't make any sense. Her arc is super
lame. It doesn't make any sense, and it also made me think that they really just don't know what to do with female characters other than have them moon over guys. Because it was the same thing that happened in Amy Adams in The Muppets.
That's true. I mean, I actually got really annoyed that Piggy's arc is entirely about her fixation on getting married. It felt really, you know, one, we've done that. And two, it just felt like Piggy is such an interesting and fun character. To see her relegated to just that was lame. And, like, even they played up so much about Piggy's engagement ring and, like, in the marketing about her dress that Vivian Westwood designed. And I got a whole press release on what a big deal that dress was. And I saw the photos. The dress is beautiful. In the movie, it is not treated like this epic thing. Like, when they presented Muppets Take Manhattan, you're shocked. It's so beautiful, and it's such a poignant moment. And in this, it's just a wide shot of her in a dress. It doesn't mean anything. Like, they could have made that such an interesting moment, and they just didn't. And it really missed the mark for me, which is a real disappointment. But I did like, I think it's fun. I don't think you need to see it in theaters. I think some of the cameos are great, but it was harsh watching Christoph Waltz in just a small cameo role, and I kept thinking, like, but if you had been in Ty Burrell's role, it would have been so much more fun. Like, I like Ty Burrell. I love Christoph Waltz. And, of course, there's Tom Hiddleston. You guys know how I feel about that. Love that. But Jermaine Clement might be my favorite cameo. I really liked him. He's Brett's partner from Flight of the Conchords, and James Bobbin directed that show, and he gets to be Prison King in this, so look out for Prison King.
I liked Ray Liotta. He was really entertaining to me, too.
He's kind of underplayed, but he's lovely.
Yeah.
Stanley Tucci's in this? I'm going to stop giving away people. Sorry.
Yeah, seriously. Spoilers.
Sorry. Well, sorry. Stanley Tucci, keep an eye out for it.
Are cameos to rattle off?
There's a whole bunch, but I don't want to be a major spoiler. But the Stanley Tucci one, I was quite delighted because I had no idea. And it's like, I feel like it's not necessarily spoiling because I'm not telling you where to find him, but look for him because it's really quick. And it's so quick that even my husband, who totally knows who Stanley Tucci is, was like, who was that? Like, you know it's somebody because anybody who is talking in this movie is famous. There's no random person got pulled in from some online audition to read a line. Even one-line roles go to famous people. So that's pretty cool.
Anyway, we should wrap up. I think in conclusion, I pretty much agree with what you said. It's fun. I think especially it's a good movie for kids. I don't think that it's something you need to go out of your way to see, especially if you're an adult, and especially if you're an adult that really loves the Muppets, because there are better ways to get your fix, like watching some of the older movies on Netflix. Anyway, so Perry, you want to take the next thing?
Yeah, well, now I'm not that bummed about not seeing Muppets. I could wait until it comes on VOD. But I did get the chance to see some of The Amazing Spider-Man 2 yesterday. I got to go to a special presentation in New York City where Mark Webb was there, and he introduced three pretty big pieces of the film, and they screened them in full, and then he got up there and did a Q&A, but the big thing is the footage. I will warn you, though, if you're the kind of person who doesn't really want to know how certain scenes play out, I'm not going to go into any crazy spoilers, but I want to tell you about the footage I saw to a point, so if you don't want to hear about that, just skip 5 minutes through this piece, and you'll hit the next topic. But we saw three pieces, and the first of which was the first 10 minutes of the movie. And the best part about that was that it was basically about a major chunk that was missing from the first Amazing Spider-Man, and it was about the parents. We basically get to see what they were up to a degree and what happened to them. And it's all great, exhilarating, but then there is a big action set piece that takes place on a private plane, and the combat and some of the digital effects that they do, and I mean even some of the practical stuff, at one point, you know, there's fighting on the plane, of course, and when a window breaks, lots of air rushes through the plane, and when you're seeing the fighting in that environment, it's pretty damn incredible. It looks great. The second piece kicked off after... this is somewhat of a spoiler, but not really, because you get a hint of it in the trailer. Gwen Stacy and Peter Parker break up at a point in the movie, and we get a conversation between the two of them. I found this a little weird, because they're both like, oh, we're broken up, and we're supposed to be friends now. But at the same time, they are so obviously, you know, being playfully romantic that it felt a little, like it was a little too much. They very clearly were basically saying to each other, oh, we're going to get back together soon, without actually getting back together. But anyway, the whole point of using that scene was to transition into the next major action set piece, which is the Times Square destruction. And wow, it's pretty damn cool. Electro is a really just cinematic character. You know, the blue lightning, and then his electro vision, which is kind of like, I guess I would kind of compare it to an X-ray, like when you look at an X-ray, uh-huh. but instead of like the bones, he's only seeing the electrical currents that are flowing through everywhere, and it looks really good. It's like just very visually appealing, and then the action that happens with that is great too. And in that scene in particular, there's a lot of slow motion Spider-Man. There's one point where he's to save a whole group of people that are kind of trapped on, you know, the red stairs in Times Square? They're all stuck there, and there's a car hurtling in their direction, and he needs to use his webs to stop the car from squishing them, and you literally see, like, boom, 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 and you follow every single web as it goes along. And it might sound like overkill, but I really liked it because that's the first time we really see that. I mean, how many times have you seen Spider-Man just, like, slinging webs in every which direction, and you don't really understand, you know, the mechanics of how they really stopped this to save this person? So I appreciated that.
And how do you think the action in the new one compares to the action in the old one?
I much prefer what I saw in terms of action here versus The Amazing Spider-Man, because in the first film, it felt like a little jumbled. It's kind of like we were just getting action for the sake of action, whereas here, it's so much more detailed, and we really get to, like, stop and think, you know, this looks pretty damn cool, or this person's ability is really cool. The first 10 minutes of the movie featured a car chase sequence with Paul Giamatti's character, the Rhino, but, like, in his human form before he becomes the Rhino. And, I mean, that was pretty much just your standard car chase. The cars drove through New York City, and Spider-Man flied around and landed on top of them. But later on, when we got the material with Electro, that felt different, very different. And I think it was because of how well they built up that character. Even in that short little span of footage we saw, he really had a lot of depth, and you did understand his whole mission with all of this, which is basically that, you know, he wants to be seen, and there's this really, I'm going to not say what I was going to say, but there's a really great turning point in that scene where you actually see Electro's, like, mind change about something. Like, he wants to do something because he sees this. It's just a very telling moment when normally we might not have had that, when normally the villain would have just, you know, destroyed because he's the villain and he's supposed to destroy. But then later on, it's also worth noting that in the third scene, that scene had action in it, but it also had a quieter moment with Jamie Foxx and Dane DeHaan, where we actually got to see the two of them, like, playing these characters mm-hmm. versus just Jamie Foxx destroying Manhattan. And the tension between the two of them and, like, the chemistry to a degree, they're butting heads a little bit, but it's, like, really palpable. You feel it. You feel the tension between the two of them. And also, Dane DeHaan looks pretty damn awesome in this role. He is just so unhinged and almost, like, in a scary respect, where he's capable of anything, and he can really just, like, snap in an instant. And I really liked what he did with that. And then
I was just going to ask how this footage may have shifted your opinion based on the trailers. There's been, like, a barrage of trailers.
I think there's one too many trailers, personally. I think they're overdoing it just a little bit, but I also think that they're very well-cut trailers. I like what I've seen in those, and based on what I saw in this screening, I don't think that they're showing too much. I think they're showing snippets of much larger scenes that you're still going to be able to appreciate as though you hadn't seen anything before. I think in context, the moments you've seen in the trailer are really going to get, like, a lot more life to them. It's good.
That's interesting to me because I've seen all the trailers, and, like, I like the first movie. I actually like their take on Peter Parker and Mary Jane far better than I like the ones from Sam Raimi's movies. And I like those movies, but I don't care about this sequel. Like, I just don't have any, like, fervent desire to see it. So it's interesting to me to hear your passion for it having seen the actual scenes. So watching the trailers, I'm like, it just looks like a barrage of, like, and stunts and visual effects. And I'm like, okay, I don't know. I'm not getting sucked into it.
There's definitely a lot of that. I'd say that if you liked the first Spider-Man, based on what I've seen so far, I think you will probably like The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And if you were underwhelmed by the first film, this one appears to have more potential. This presentation and what I saw made me look forward to it even more than I already had been.
Sounds like a best case scenario.
Yeah. All right, on to the next one. Christy, you want to take Pan?
Yeah, we're going to move into a news story. So for those who may not have heard, Joe Wright is directing a live-action origin story for Sony about Peter Pan. It's called Simply Pan. And a lot of people are really excited about this because Joe Wright has done movies like Atonement and Anna Karenina and Pride and Prejudice. He's really great at making adaptations of beloved books. Then things got tricky because he cast Rooney Mara as Tiger Lily, the quote-unquote Indian princess. We're going to go from, say, Native American from this point on, but in J.M. Barrie's world, she was effectively a fantasy figure like the pirates and da-da-da-da, and you never hear about people saying Native American princess, so just bear with me on that point. But this caused a lot of outrage, and I was writing about it on CinemaBlend. You can read the full article there. It explains about this petition and everything. But there's been an online petition formed asking for Sony, or asking in general that people stop... you know what, I don't think it's actually Sony, so apologies on that, but asking for studios to stop casting white actors in quote-unquote people of color roles. And some people in comments got very fired up and started pointing to the casting of Michael B. Jordan and saying, it works both ways. Here's the thing, it doesn't. It's a matter of a couple of things. First off is representation. If you look at Hollywood movies, most of them are specifically about white males. That's not opinion, that's just fact, look around, that's just how it happens. Occasionally you have someone that breaks out anyway, despite this kind of, this environment of putting forth movies that are specifically about white men, like we're seeing an increase in the movies about white women, but less so in kind of any other quote-unquote minority. So when someone like Michael B. Jordan gets cast in a role that is presumably written about a white guy, because in the comics Johnny Storm was white, that's not such a big deal because there are still literally millions of roles and millions of movies where white guys are in the protagonist role. Conversely, when you look at people of color, they are far less represented in American theater or American cinema. So when a role that presumably was going to go to a Native American actress or at least somebody who looks remotely Native American goes to a girl who is hands down a white girl, that causes upset. That upsets the scales because the representation that is almost guaranteed to go to people of color is now going to white people who already have the majority of representation. So that's where the outrage comes from, and that's why you can't really call that a double standard, because as much as we might want to believe it, we're not equal yet. It's not that I have an issue with Rooney Mara. I think she's a fantastic actress. I think she's beautiful. I think the problem is more about the context of whitewashing and how it is a recurring problem. So it's not so much about Rooney Mara. It's about this continual idea of the idea that, like, white people already get the majority of the roles, and now let's all, like, and they continue to also get roles that are effectively earmarked.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is probably an oversimplification, but it's basically the difference between stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, and stealing from the poor and giving to the rich. You know, that's a little, like I said, that's a little oversimplified, but what I'm saying is it's not equal. And one other thing that annoyed me is that when the Rooney Mara casting came out, a lot of reports were like, oh, you know, sources inside the production say that Joe Wright is aiming for a really diverse, multicultural cast, and it was just like, really? Is that why you gave one of the roles that is specifically a character of color to a white girl? Is that why the only other two actors announced at that point were both white men? Like, it just seemed like such... I guess what he was trying to do, or what the, you know, press marketing people were trying to do, was to kind of get ahead of it by being like, oh, you know, but we promise we're actually not going to just populate the whole thing with white people. But it came across as just like... almost like I was almost more annoyed that they said that, because I was just like, no, you do not get off the hook for promising that eventually we might see, like, a black actor in, like, some other role. Like, unless you're actually going to do it, unless you've actually done it, I don't want to hear it right now. Like, you don't get credit for having a diverse cast because you cast three white people, including one in a role that is supposed to be for a person of color.
And one thing I want to address, because a lot of people on our comments have said things like, she's a great actress, what's the problem? Casting isn't just about talent. And, like, we all know that. It's also about being correct for the role in whatever form that might mean. And when you're going to talk about casting a character who is an Indian princess, casting a lily white actress is a problem. I mean, like, you know, people had problems with this when Johnny Depp got cast as Tonto. You know, there's a lot going on with that. It's about representation, and it's about you know, how uneven the scales actually are. And we can pretend all we want that, like, they're equal and everybody's treated the same, but it's not true. And bringing this up doesn't make things worse. It just draws attention to how things are not okay yet.
Maybe they're going to change Tiger Lily's origins or something.
Yeah, I'm sure that they'll have some explanation for it, but yeah, that's not
what I want. I want a free, after all this, I want an official statement. I want, like, a real answer as to why they did this. And, you know, if they have a good enough reason, like she is, you know, talented enough for this specific reason that someone else might not have had, I'm fine with it. But, you know, from our perspective right now, without any context, all we can look at it as, you know, you put a white person in a role that is not meant for a white person, period.
Yeah, and, like, I like Joe Wright as a filmmaker, so I'm interested to hear what he has to say about this. I'm not saying, like, boycott the movie or he's the worst. I'm saying this does fall into whitewashing, which makes it something that's cringeworthy. Like, we don't know what the results are yet, but I can understand people being reactionary is basically my point on this.
Yeah, I think at this point I've just... It maybe, you know, if he honestly is trying to have a more diverse cast, I think at this point I'm just hoping that, like, every other major character you announce...
Peter Pan's a white kid. They cast it.
Sorry?
So, Peter Pan's a white kid. They cast it.
Yeah, so
anybody who's being like, well, maybe... Nope. Also that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he'll have some extras that are Asian or Latino or something.
Two lines that are...
Yeah,
one random lost boy.
Yeah. But the mermaids will be Asian or something. You're welcome, world.
Yeah, that's not really a good start to what he is saying is going to be an international and diverse cast. That's all
I'm saying. Hashtag fixing racism.
Right.
All right, on to the next topic. The big new release of the weekend. I guess, actually, I don't know, Muppets is kind of big too, but it looks like Divergent could possibly win based on projections. So Divergent. Yeah. Most of you probably know the basics, but it takes place in a future version of Chicago where society is divided up into five factions based on your core values: abnegation for selflessness, dauntless for bravery, erudite for intelligence, candor for honesty, and amity for peace. And our hero is played by Shailene Woodley. Her name at the beginning of the movie is Beatrice. Eventually that changes to Trish because when everyone turns 16 in society, they're expected to take an aptitude test. When they take this test, it tells them which faction they are meant to be in or best suited for. And then shortly after that, there is the choosing ceremony where someone gets up on a stage, has to slice their hand open and drip their blood over the faction of their choosing. And that could either adhere to their aptitude test results or they could just follow their gut and leave their families behind and pick what they want. And Beatrice decides to do just that. She leaves abnegation behind and she goes into Dauntless, and the large majority of the movie is about her trying to make it through Dauntless initiation, which is really tough, a lot of physical violence that she's got to, like, power through and become strong and a fighter and all that. But then there's also a war waging on between two of the factions, and there's something brewing in there as well, which I'm not going to spoil, but that's basically the gist of what happens in this movie. And I am a fan of the books. I like them quite a bit, and I like the movie quite a bit. I know it is not doing too hot on the tomato meter right now, but I guess I'm in the minority because I've seen it twice before, and I really love it. And not only do I just love it, but, like, having watched it two times through, I'm having a hard time figuring out why people are trashing it so much. I really don't think it deserves that. I mean, everyone's been talking about Shailene Woodley. That's one thing that's kind of standard across the board at this point. She does make this movie. This wouldn't have been a good movie, I don't think, without her. But I found the production value to be through the roof. I thought all the set extensions looked incredible. The city looked great. The costumes were on point. The action was incredible. That stunt coordinator really has something. He needs to get more attention, Garrett Warren, because the fighting style in this is just so unique and so visceral and just like really, I mean, it's kind of off-putting, I guess, to a point when you see Shailene Woodley, who is, like, little and frail, going up against someone like Miles Teller, who really...
I don't know. I kind of loved that. I mean, you know, she gets the crap beat out of her a few times, but it was just really interesting. I think, like you said, the hand-to-hand combat scenes are really well choreographed, and Shailene Woodley really takes them very well. So I enjoyed watching Shailene Woodley, you know, get beat up. I enjoyed watching her beat other people up. But overall, I wouldn't say that I would trash it, but I'm one of the people who liked it a little bit less. So
But what did you like it? Like, would you give it a positive review?
I would probably be like right down the middle. Like, not positive, not negative. It had some good qualities. It had some bad qualities. Like you said, one of the very, very good qualities is Shailene Woodley. She's really good. You know, she's someone that's just naturally compelling. Like, you want to watch her, and you want to watch what you want to find out what happens to her, and because of that you care a lot about what happens to the character. One of the other major roles is her love interest slash mentor. His name is Four, and he's played by Theo James, whom I will always think of as Mr. Pamuk from Downton Abbey, but apparently he does other things also, and he is also pretty good. He doesn't have as much to do, and his character is kind of like the standard, like, you know, brooding and intense, but secretly he's really passionate and kind types. But I think that he brings does as much as he can to bring a lot of feeling and personality into the role.
Yeah, so, he was what I was worried about most. I got to go on a set visit for this last year, and I saw the scene where they come out of the pit after the capture the flag type thing, and it was that scene where it's literally just him talking to Shailene Woodley, and like, my heart broke when I was watching that on set, because he was so freaking wooden and lifeless, and she had so much going, and you could really just see the difference. But I guess now I just have to blame that on the fact that I saw that dialogue happen out of context, because in the movie, he just nails this role. He is so perfect at it. I mean, he doesn't make as much of a connection with the viewer as Shailene Woodley does, but I don't necessarily think that was his purpose anyway. I kind of like the balance that he had with her, and, you know, he was kind of, you know, your typical hardcore instructor, I have no heart kind of thing. And then I did think he handled that transition well, where, like, slowly she chips away until, you know, then we're back on, you know, another side of that spectrum where we get the quintessential romance.
Right. But one thing I didn't like, or I had many problems with this movie, and one of them is not really anyone in the movie's fault. It's that, to me, the entire premise, just from the outset, doesn't make any sense. And I don't know. I haven't read the other books. Maybe later on it's explained a little bit better or something. But to me, the entire idea that a society would be like, you know what's a brilliant idea? Dividing our entire population by personality, I don't get it. And then there's the fact that, I don't know, there's a lot of things that don't really make sense. Like, I know that, you know, Triss is a threat to the system because she's a divergent, meaning she can fit in more than one faction. But everyone's allowed to choose their own factions anyway, so I don't really understand why that's that much of an issue either. I don't know. I had a lot of questions.
No, I have a question.
Like, yeah, go ahead.
Have you read the book?
I read the first book. I haven't read the other two, although I've picked up some of the plot points from, like, Wikipedia and just from talking to people.
And Perry, you read the book.
That I have, all three.
So the division on this is not from the... I was wondering if the division was, like, Vampire Academy, where, like, you had actually read the book, so you already had something going in where you were able to kind of fill in the gaps and the characterization.
I'm actually able to pinpoint certain things in this movie that I know for a fact will not hit home for people that haven't read the book. And I actually did two reviews on this movie. I wrote one from the perspective of a critic, like, completely unbiased. I know I love the book, but completely pushed that away. And then I wrote one from the fan perspective. And I'm positive on both ends of the spectrum, but there's certain things I can appreciate in one respect and certain that I can appreciate in another. And one issue with this movie, I think, as a fan of the book, is I don't think it treats some of the supporting characters as well as it should. I think a bunch of them are really underdeveloped, specifically Triss's friends in the initiation class. They're a big part of this book, especially this one. The one that bothers me the most is this one character, Al, who is played by Christian Madsen in the film, who I don't think is that good anyway. I think even if they, you know, boosted the amount of material, he might be a little too stiff to have actually nailed it anyway. But in the book, that character has so much depth to it. There's so many layers to him. He's got, like, a crush on Triss. He is so apprehensive about hurting people. Like, he went to Dauntless to be able to protect people, not hurt people. And that's something that, like, really messes with his head. And it's like, the book explains it all and then has this really big thing happen to him. And the movie has the big thing happen to him, but none of what built up to it before.
You know, I don't think you even have to be a huge fan of the books to understand that the supporting characters are shortchanged, because they really just don't get that much to do, to the point where it's just kind of like, it kind of felt like, especially her male friends, because at least Christina, played by Zoe Kravitz, gets, like, an inkling of a personality, but her male friends were practically interchangeable to me, and it kind of just felt like they were there to be, like, you know, set decoration. Like, well, we can't just have her sitting by herself, so let's have her sitting next to these people so it looks like she has friends. But I think that the real divide between me and Perry might be that we've both read the book, we both saw the movie, but I think that Perry bought into the core concept a lot better than I did. Like, to me, that's just such a sticking point that I have trouble getting past. And to me, and with the movie specifically, I don't think that they did... Well, no, not with the movie specifically, with both. I don't think that they do a very good job of building up this world. I mean, Perry's right, the production values are there, but it still just looks like kind of generic, dystopian, futuristic sci-fi, post-apocalyptic. Like, it to me, it mostly looked like every other, you know, future dystopia sci-fi world that I've seen.
As I hadn't gotten a chance to see it, Ireland. Do you think,
hashtag humble brag?
Do you think that the film is relying on the audience already being on board with the concept because of the popularity of the books, or do you think that's just a mistake that they didn't even consider?
I don't think they're relying on anything at all, because, like, the trailers have constantly, you know, rehashed the basics over and over, and they do the same exact thing in the movie. They make an attempt at getting you up to speed.
I don't think they ever satisfactorily explain it for people like me who are like, that sounds like a kind of a dumb idea to begin with. So I don't think, in that respect, I don't think they explain it. But you don't have to know any of this stuff going into the movie. Like, they explain it thoroughly.
I think the problem is they're almost too loyal to the book in that they really tried to squeeze everything in, and then everything is just, like, so incredibly thin most of the way through in terms of like this core concept and why when I read the book I believed it so much, and I guess that probably carried over into the movie as well. But not that I treat that as a serious thing, but I do buy into it. I have fun with things like that. Like, I love the thought that, like, ooh, if I was in this society, what would I be? I like that idea. And I mean, really, it's kind of like a very exaggerated way of how, like, we live. I mean, people just get attracted to like-minded people, and I mean, this is an absurd version of that, but I don't know, there is that piece
to it. I get what you're saying, but just, I don't know, there was, like, some practical part of my, I mean, I get what you're saying, like, in theory, the concept makes sense, you know, I can kind of see the appeal, and it's the same thing, like, when I read Harry Potter, I'm like, ooh, which house would I be in, and, like, when I watch Game of Thrones, I, like, get excited about rooting for one house or the other, but I don't know, there was just, like, a practical part of my brain that was just, like, sitting there, like, you know, arms crossed, being like, that doesn't make any fucking sense. And
if you had that issue with this movie, the whole movie is just, like, kind of dead. Because that's what every thought point rides on.
Right, but then I'm saying on top of that, I also just don't think that they did a good job of building up the world. Like, to me, it felt generic. It felt like they didn't really think things through. There's no real... Like, I was like, I don't really understand how this world works. I don't really understand what kind of city this is. Like, I don't understand what the social mores are, or, you know, like, what's important to these people, and, like, those are things that I, you know, whether or not you buy into the core concept, I think it's important that they build up those kinds of things, and I didn't see nearly as much of that as I would have liked.
A lot of that was missing, admittedly. Like, I mean, they didn't even refer to that main building as the hub, which kind of already hints at what it is, and then you kind of end up wondering, well, if that building's there, what's around it? Like, the geography of it wasn't very well explained. And then also smaller details, like in the book, they go through, you know, how many cars are on the street. Here, it would have been nice if they explained a little more, because then when you see Kate Winslet's car blow through the city and there's not a single other car, it's like, that's kind of silly looking. Things like that. Could have used a little more explaining.
I think that you know, if they had done a little bit better job of building up the world, this would have been a much better movie, even if I had trouble getting past some of the concepts, and especially because it has such good, such charismatic stars at the core.
I think it's got a lot of potential, though, down the line. Even though the reviews are not too hot, I think it's still tracking very well, based on what I hear. And I'm thinking this thing is going to make between 50 and 60 million at least. That's going to get the green light on the sequel, and hopefully they can, you know, take a cue from some of the reactions they're getting here and actually make the second better, which would be nice to see.
Hey, but they did it with Hunger Games.
Like, yeah,
that's true. That's but actually I'm a very good example.
I'm still going to recommend seeing this in theaters and in IMAX. I think the visuals are pretty damn stunning, and I was really taken by the whole scenario and some of the characters, and it's just a really thrilling experience. I got to see it when I saw it a second time. One of my favorite things about seeing a movie twice is when you're sitting through a movie and you have that feeling where you're always looking forward to the scene to come, and I definitely had that. I very much enjoyed it twice, so I would definitely recommend that you see it once. Angie, what about you?
I think that if you saw the trailers and you thought that looks pretty fun, you should watch it. And if you saw the trailers and thought that looks pretty stupid, you shouldn't. Which I know is just like the most simplistic way of doing it, but like I said, I kind of fell like right down the middle on this one. Like I thought it
had
good
quality. The trailers are actually a good indication of the movie.
I think it's I think reasonably so.
I would agree with that. All right.
But yeah, it does have good performances, so that if you are going to watch it, that's one good reason. Two good reasons.
I can agree with that. But that is all the time we've got for you guys this week. If you enjoyed the show, you can keep following along at popcornprosecco.com, on Twitter at popcornprosecco, and also subscribe to our YouTube channel, Popcorn Prosecco. And of course, you can catch all three of us all over the web. Angie, where can viewers find you?
I write for Slash Film, which is at slashfilm.com, and you can find me on Twitter at AJ Hahn.
Christy?
I'm a freelancer writing for Cinema Blend and Pop Crush most often, but if you go to decadentcriminals.com, you'll see my highlights. That's my personal blog, and you can follow me at Christy Puchko on Twitter, KristyPuchko.
And I am at shocky.com, movies.com, comingsoon.net, collider.com, we got this covered, screenrant.com, and of course on Twitter, my handle is pnemiroff. Thank you guys so much for watching. We'll see you next week.
Have a good weekend, all.
Bye.